capture.
All right, thanks. Yeah, thank you all for being here. And I was asked by the organizers of the Quantum Dynamics Workshop to give a talk that should be accessible to the members of the other program, which is Chaos and Order, and convey a sense of the kinds of questions that we're thinking about. And I think it's a testament to this really exciting time that we're in that, you know, I didn't really have to deviate very much from a talk that I would have normally given anyway. And it's pretty nice that we have these two programs running from these very different communities of people, but you know, we're really starting to ask very similar kinds of questions. Okay, so you know, broadly, a lot of the questions that we're thinking about in the quantum dynamics program have to do with the unitary dynamics of many-body quantum systems. Okay, so these are systems of spins, atoms, black holes. And you know, I really want to be thinking about systems that are truly many bodies, so they're strongly interacting degrees of freedom. There's no very simple single particle description for these, right? And in this context, we can ask a variety of questions. The most perhaps fundamental one that's occupied a lot of our attention in recent times has been whether an isolated system undergoing unitary time evolution is able to serve as its own bath in some sense, right? So the question is, can an isolated system bring its subsystems to thermal equilibrium? If it does so, how fast does it do so? What are the dynamics of entanglement during this thermalization process? Okay. Of course, a lot of excitement has come from the realization that not all quantum systems undergoing unitary time evolution do reach thermal equilibrium. And when they don't, these are the so-called many-body localized systems. And a major open question is the nature of this transition between thermalizing and localized systems. Okay? And all of these really, again, have to do with the dynamics of quantum information in the system and how that's evolving in time. Right? So more broadly, you can ask, what are all possible dynamical universality classes for systems? Right? So there's a simple yes or no answer to, does the system bring its subsystems to thermal equilibrium, but you can ask, you know, how fast, what are the timescales, what about systems that take very, very long to do so, but eventually do reach thermal equilibrium? Should we treat these as a different dynamical universality class? What about systems in which some states reach equilibrium but others don't, right? More broadly, you can ask, what are all possible non-equilibrium dynamical phases of matter, right? So these could be systems that may or may not reach equilibrium, but then you can have further distinctions to classify different kinds of phases further signatures that are only visible in the dynamics of the problem. Okay. In this talk, I want to focus on this set of questions in this bottom section, 5 to 7. And the questions have to do with thermalization in the presence of one or few conservation laws, okay? So this could be conservation of energy, conservation of charge. Essentially, I have some slow hydrodynamic mode in the system having to do with this conservation law, okay? And the question is, how does dissipative hydrodynamics, right? So if you have a charge, you know that the charge is going to be diffusing in time. So this is a slow dissipative hydrodynamic process. And the question is, how does dissipative hydrodynamics emerge from reversible unitary dynamics? Okay, so unitary time evolution is inherently reversible. So how do you get this dissipative process from underlying dynamics that are purely reversible? And I also want to touch on some more general questions, which is there really a way to precisely formulate a notion of many-body quantum chaos that's distinct from thermalization, okay? So one of the upshots of the last decade, starting, of course, with the works of Deutsch and Chernicki, has been that we now have a very useful, we have a concrete notion of what it means for a system to reach local thermal equilibrium, okay? And what we mean by that is, if I look at the late time limit of small subsystems in some larger system, then they agree with what you would expect from thermal equilibrium, right? You can choose your favorite equilibrium ensemble that's characterized by some temperatures, chemical potentials, and as far as local observables are concerned, you can do unitary time evolution and you get the same answer at late times for local observables as you would in equilibrium, okay? So this is a well-defined notion of what it means for a system to thermalize. By contrast, what is an equally well-defined notion for what it means for a system to be quantum chaotic? right? Should we give a couple of minutes for people to settle down? Or?
I think we're good.
Okay, all right.
You have their attention.
Okay. All right. And in particular, is it distinct from thermalization? Okay. So a lot of the questions that are being discussed in this parallel program on chaos and order have to do with quantum chaos. But a lot of these systems that people are thinking about in this program have to do with systems which are in some large end limit or in some kind of solvable limit having to do with either gravity or some weak coupling or semi-classics. And, you know, when I'm asking this question, I really want to think in full generality. So I could be thinking of a spin one-half system with no large S limit, no large N limits, okay? And I know that this system is thermalizing, and the question is, is there a notion that this system is also chaotic in a way that's distinct from thermalization, okay? And correspondingly, I want to also ask whether there are distinct universal signatures of chaos at different time scales. Okay, so this connects to something that we heard about from Steve Shanker last week, right? So we know that in a regular many-body system, there's many, many different time scales which are separated in the thermodynamic limit. The longest time scales have to do with inverse level spacing, right? So in a many-body system where the level spacings are exponentially small in system size, these time scales are exponentially large, okay? And here, there are very well-defined signatures of chaos that have been known for a long time, which have to do with whether or not you see level repulsion, right, between these nearby many-body level spacings. Okay, so this is really probing timescales that are exponentially large in the system size. But of course, we know there are many other timescales as well. One of these is the so-called Thouless time, which usually scales polynomially in system size, right? So this is usually like L squared in a system with diffusion. So the Thouless time is also very big, but it's parametrically smaller than the level spacing, okay? And then a time scale that people are discussing much more now has to do with a short time signature of chaos, which is the so-called Lyapunov time, right? So in general, this Lyapunov time can be very much smaller than both the Thouless time and this inverse level spacing time, okay? And the Lyapunov time has to do with this idea that if you come in and you make some small perturbation in the system, classically, of course, if your system is chaotic, you expect your trajectories before and after you made the perturbation to exponentially diverge. And that time scale for divergence for this initial perturbation that you made is given by the so-called Lyapunov time, okay? And one of the questions that I'll talk about is whether or not we can meaningfully think of this short time diagnostic of chaos in a spin one half system away from any of these large end limits. Okay, and if we cannot, then what does this regime even exist? And if it does, what are the most appropriate variables for probing it? Okay, good. So, a useful lens into all these different questions has come from looking at the dynamics of operator spreading. So this is the dynamics of operators in the Heisenberg picture, okay? So let me look at some operator, which is initially at time zero, at position zero, how this spreads out under unitary evolution, okay? And what we know is that in a thermalizing system, so I'm not thinking of disordered or many-body localized systems here, in a thermalizing system, this operator spreads out within some Lieb-Robinson or butterfly cone, right? And it becomes highly entangled and generic within this cone, okay? So the way to probe this spreading, one useful way to probe it, which is also a diagnostic that has been used as an early time diagnostic of chaos, is the so-called out-of-time commutator, which looks at the commutator between this spreading operator, W naught of t, and a local operator situated somewhere else at position x, okay? And the picture here is that at early times, if 0 and x are far separated, then this location, this operator, is well outside this Lieb-Robinson cone for the spreading operator. So this commutator is approximately 0. But as this operator spreads and enters this, as the Lieb-Robinson cone enters this position, you see a sharp increase in this. in this commutator. Okay? So the reason that this has been thought of as a diagnostic of chaos is that if you look at a semi-classical analog of this quantity with your commutator is becoming Poisson brackets, then what you find is that this directly probes the sensitivity of trajectories to small changes in the initial conditions, which for classically chaotic systems increases exponentially with the so-called Lyapunov exponent. Okay. So I want to think about these again in this context of spin one-half systems, right? So away from this kind of semi-classical picture. So more concretely, let me imagine that I'm working in one dimension, though that won't be super important. And let's say that I have a spin one-half degree of freedom. So this is spin one-half on every site, okay? And then, right, so this Q is referring to my local Hilbert space dimension, okay? And what I can do is I can also use this to define a basis of orthonormal operators, okay? So this, on every site, if you're up or down, this defines an orthonormal basis for your states, right? And for operators, I can define a 4 to the L dimensional basis, which have to do with the, which have the Pauli operators on each site, right? Which are defined by the Pauli operators. So a Pauli string looks like some pattern of 1, 1, 1, z, y, right? Z, y, x, and so on, okay? So there's 4 to the L such Pauli strings, and together they define a complete orthonormal basis in which any operator can be expanded, okay? And the orthonormality, so these are my strings, and the orthonormality is with respect to the trace norm. Which looks like that, okay? So to see how an operator is spreading in space-time, I take this operator that I've written, which is evolving under unitary time evolution, and I expand it in this Pauli basis. This is a function of time, and that, right? So this is a set of, again, 4 to the L dimensional Pauli strings, and any operator, including the one that's expanding, can be written in this basis, okay? So, of course, fully characterizing the spreading operator is going to require me to tell you something about how each of these 4 to the L coefficients are evolving in time, right? So that's a super, that's a very complex problem, and I'm not sure it's particularly illuminating. So instead, we can look at more coarse-grained measures for how this operator is evolving, okay? And in particular, one measure that you can look at is how the edges of the operator, right? So this operator, as it's spreading, has a right edge and a left edge. And you can ask, yeah?
Do you mean AS only?
Sorry?
For the coefficients, without the square?
Yes, sorry. Yes, yes. I'm just jumping ahead with the square. Sorry. Yeah, good. So you can ask how the right edge and the left edge of the operator is evolving in time. Okay. So in particular, what you get from unitarity, right? So unitarity tells you that the norms of operators are conserved in time, and I can choose an initially normalized operator so that at time zero, this norm is one, right? And in terms of these operator coefficients, what unitarity translates into is a sum rule. This is where the square comes in. Is a sum rule on these 4 to the L dimensional.
So one is L dagger or both is dagger?
One
the other ones don't have dagger, or should be a T?
Yes. Okay, sorry. Yeah. Okay. So what unitarity translates into is a sum rule on these squared coefficients, okay? So if my operator is normalized, And this is, if you will, an emergent conservation law from unitarity. Okay. But now let's write this in an even more transparent form, okay, which has to do with what these right and left edges of my operator are doing. And to do this, let me classify all my different Pauli strings by their right and left endpoints. Okay? So for instance, I can have some string S, which is identity everywhere, non-identity here, on some position x1. And then it can be arbitrary, then it's non-identity on some position x2, and then it's identity everywhere else. Okay? So for this particular Pauli string, it has its right edge at x2 and its left edge at x1, right? And when you look at the initial operator, which was just a single operator at the origin, for instance, right? This was an operator which had its right and left edges just at some particular location, which was the origin. And as time evolves and your operator becomes more and more non-local, what it means is that it develops weight on longer and longer Pauli strings. Right? So it develops weight on Pauli strings whose right edge is moving further to the right and whose left edge is moving further to the left. Okay? And one way to characterize this is to define the right weight of the operator. And you can do this analogously for the left weight as well. And this is the weight of the operator on all strings such that the rightmost endpoint of the string is at position x. Okay, so for every string, it has a unique right endpoint. Okay, and we can break up this operator expansion into the parts on different strings which end at different endpoints. Okay, so notice that this quantity is just a rearrangement of this total sum rule on the operator weights. Okay. So what this tells you is that now, if you look at x going from 1 to L, where L is my system size, rho sub r on x and t is 1. Okay. So this now very much looks like a particle, right? This is a particle which lives somewhere on position x, and the total density of this particle everywhere in space is conserved. Right, so you've got this emergent density, which is followed just from unitarity. Okay, and this was really worked out in this set of papers right here. Okay, so this is the density which characterizes this right endpoint for the operator, and the fact that it sums to 1 means that with Your operator is always somewhere in space, right? This is just like our usual conservation law on a density. Okay. And so now you can ask about the dynamics of this object. And this is very nice because it's very... I don't have to think about what 4 to the L... Yeah.
Yeah, just maybe a technical question. So if you spell out the expression that you just circled or framed,
yeah,
you get a double sum.
That's right.
Times.
That's right.
And that just becomes the second line.
That just becomes this. That's right. Because every Pauli string has exactly 1 endpoint, right?
Okay.
So every Pauli string can be labeled by an endpoint.
Okay.
And you're just grouping together all the strings with their endpoint on some side x. Yeah.
What about the ones that have like holes in them?
That's right. So it can be completely arbitrary in the middle.
Yeah.
So it's just all you need is that it's identity beyond position x. So the holes, you know, so this could be x hole, y hole, that's fine. But it still means that the right endpoint is here and it's all identity beyond.
I mean, I guess it would just make the analysis way too annoying if you tried to have like two things, and because I'd imagine that if you just had two things, they just both grow out the same way until they start interacting with each other.
Right, right.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, so you can play the games like that, and we did, but let me keep it simple for now. Yeah. Okay. Good. So now, instead of thinking about what all these 4 to the L coefficients are doing in time, which is not that illuminating, I can ask about what this right density is doing in time, right? And that's physically telling me about what the right edge of this operator is doing. And that's going to be very helpful in thinking about things. Yeah.
It feels like there's something not conserving about these edges, because let's say you had a domain, a solid domain with no holes, but then it splintered and created one hole.
Right.
Now you've created an edge at this new position.
But I'm not treating that. I'm not going to treat it as an edge. So what you're saying is you have an operator which is, you know, like that, and then, you know, if you have something like that, right?
I had an operator that had no holes.
Okay.
And then I created one hole in the middle.
Okay, but that's still, so you have
Is that row one?
No, but it's still, here's your hole, but the right edge of this is still going to go like that, right? So.
Oh.
So your hole is there, but I'm just looking at the operator as a whole. As a whole.
And, okay. Is there a row of R for every edge?
No, every Pauli string has... the row of R for every Pauli string looks like a delta function, and it's a delta function where that string has its last endpoint.
Oh, last endpoint. Okay.
That's right. So this can be arbitrary in the middle. So this is... There can be as many holes as you want in here.
It's the last endpoint.
Yeah. Because I really want the right edge of the operator. There's lots of other metrics you can consider, right? You can ask, like, what's the weight on operators with Hamming distance n, right? So you have, like, n non-identity operators. You can have what's the weight on operators with n-to-n distance l, so it doesn't matter where the right edge is. So there's many different measures you can consider.
It's kind of coarser measure.
This is one measure. That's right. So a lot of these others are useful for different purposes, but just from the point of view of seeing where this operator is spatially, this is a useful one. Okay. Good. So as I said, as this operator is spreading in time, its weight is spreading out in space, that its weight is moving to longer and longer Pauli strings, or Pauli strings with right edges further to the right and left edges further to the left. Okay. And now what was really nice in that set of papers that I pointed out is that you can show that the dynamics of this right front actually looks like Bayes diffusion. Okay, so if you look at U dagger, yeah, I'll tell you what that means in a second. This has some amplitude for making S shorter, okay, for leaving it the same, and then for making it longer. So this can be very exactly worked out in a model where your unitary time evolution is actually generated by this random unitary circuit. So everything that I'm saying, the qualitative picture continues to hold for a simple Hamiltonian system, okay? But we can't do many things exactly for many body dynamics with simple Hamiltonians. So this can be made precise if you're thinking about time evolution generated by a circuit of this form. So it's a discrete time evolution, okay? And each circuit gate is independently Haar random in both space and time, okay? And then we can average over the space of all unitaries generated in this way, okay? And so what this means is that I had some Pauli string that was doing whatever it wanted over here, as many holes as you want, but its right endpoint was at this location at some given time step, okay? And now I act with a unitary gate on this time step. And the idea is that under unitary time evolution, which is perfectly Haar random, every non-identity operator can go to every other non-identity operator with equal probability, okay? So when you act with this locally on this gate, there are many, many more ways for you to end up with a situation in which this grew rather than the fact that it remained the same, okay? So that's where this bias comes from, right? In general, you know that your entanglement is going to grow, your operators are going to grow and spread out in time. So when you're acting with this unitary gate that spreads out your operator, right, so this is O, U dagger U will look like that, when you're acting with this unitary gate, in general, there are many more ways for your operator to grow than there is to shrink. And in this Haar random unitary picture, it's just this simple probabilistic counting, okay? So what you end up getting is, if you looked at the dynamics of your front, it looks like this bias diffusion process, and you can write down a coarse-grained hydrodynamic equation for it, which basically looks like so this is the diffusion, and this is the fact that it's got a net bias, so it's going to propagate. And so solving this gives me something which looks like your right edge is this Gaussian wave packet that's propagating at a velocity vb, but as it's propagating, it's also spreading out. Okay, yeah?
Does it notice the edge of the system?
Does it notice the edge? Yes. So I'm thinking about an infinite system.
Okay.
Yeah. But yeah, once it gets to the edge of the system, it can't go anywhere and then starts piling up at the edge.
Okay.
Yeah.
So,
what
sets vb and v? Are there relations between the two?
Yes, okay. Yes. So, well, 1 second. So let me just sketch a picture of this. Okay. So this is a snapshot of the right weight and the left weight. Okay, so this is position. This is centered at VBT. This is minus VBT. I can concoct examples where the left and right weights move at different speeds. Let me not get into that. And then the shape of this is square root of T. Or not the shape, the width of it, okay? So your question about what sets VB in this circuit model, it's entirely set by some probabilistic treatments, right? So the question is, suppose you have a circuit with local Hilbert space dimension Q for a spin 1/2 system that's Q equals 2. Then you can ask, how many ways are there, like how many ways are there for this string to grow in time versus for it to shrink at the next step? And that just has to do with the counting of how many total operators you have. Right, and when you put that together, so because you've written this as Bayes diffusion, your butterfly speed is just the probability to move forwards minus the probability to move backwards, and you can get your diffusion equation in the same way, right? So you end up with a butterfly speed, which I believe is q squared minus 1 over q squared plus 1. Okay, don't quote me on this, but I know that it has this asymptotic form at large Q. Okay, so as your Q becomes larger and larger, it becomes overwhelmingly likely that your string is going to grow, right? So in the Q goes to infinity limit, your dq scales is 1 over Q squared. Okay, so in the Q goes to infinity limit, you basically end up with a deterministic problem where you have a wavefront that's definitely traveling forwards. Your butterfly speed is 1, and your diffusion for this wavefront is 0. Okay, so this becomes a sharp shock wave, if you will. Okay, so here I want to emphasize that.
So does 1 correspond to the Lieb-Robinson velocity?
Oh, good. So the Lieb-Robinson. So the butterfly speed can be defined at any temperature. Mm-hmm. So the way I've been doing it, I've just been taking traces of things. So it is an infinite temperature quantity. Mm-hmm. So at infinite temperature, the butterfly speed is analogous to the Lieb-Robinson speed, and I say analogous just because technically Lieb-Robinson used a slightly different operator norm, but okay, they're morally the same. But the butterfly speed can be made smaller as you lower your temperature. So the Lieb-Robinson speed is an upper bound.
Can you tell me, what's this Q? What's the physical meaning of Q?
Q is the local Hilbert space dimension. So I, in this problem, when I was looking at a spin 1/2 system, Q was 2. But I could look at spin 1, spin 2, spin 3, spin Q, right? Not spin Q, but so it's like 2s plus 1. Okay? Good. Right. So here I want to mention that, you know, this broadening of the front, okay? This is the main reason why thinking about a Lyapunov exponent in this kind of strongly quantum system, spin 1/2 is one example, right, becomes problematic. Okay, so in the pictures that you have in these large N SYK models and these semi-classical treatments with weak interactions, the operator front basically looks like a shock wave that's traveling in time. Okay, so it's moving, but it's a sharp wave front. Okay, the wave front isn't really spreading out. And that's just because you can, in taking those limits of large N or large Q or small system size or even large spatial dimension, you can suppress this quantum noise that causes this wave front to spread out. Okay, and when that happens and you have this sharp wave packet, okay, you can get this Lyapunov exponent, because the question is just if you're waiting around at this position X for the operator to get to you, you have a tiny commutator, but then as soon as the operator gets to you, you end up seeing this sharp increase, right? And the time scale on which you see the increase is actually set by the width of that operator front, okay? So,
But if you represented it in frequency space, yes, then it would split into two different types of dynamics. One for very high frequencies, which is perfectly deterministic, and one for very low frequencies, which is diffusive. Is that correct?
If you've decided to do this in frequency space. Yes. There is something which is going at speed VBT, so yes. But then there's also this diffusion, and what the diffusion means is that if you look at some...
Right, but when you're faced with the solution, let's say at the Langevin equation, you do it in frequency space, so that you can separate the free dynamics at high frequencies from the diffusive dynamics at low frequencies.
Sure.
Then you get two different sets of phenomena in the same system.
Sure, yeah. And actually, the example that I'll talk about next very much more has that.
Okay.
So I'll get to that in a second. But the point I was making is that the time it takes for your operator to grow, the commutator to grow from something tiny to something large, is set by the width of this wave packet. Okay. And when your wave packet is itself dependent on time, you don't have a well-defined position-independent Lyapunov exponent. Okay, because in this position over here, the time it takes goes as square root of t, which grows as square root of x. Okay, but if this was constant, then at every position, you could define this Lyapunov exponent. It would not be something position dependent. Okay, so I'll come back to this point, but I just wanted to flag at this moment, in case we don't get there, that the fact that these wave packets are spreading, which is a very generic thing for it to happen away from any of these large N limits. So for your regular spin 1/2 systems, these operator fronts will be spreading in time. And when they do, you cannot define a Lyapunov exponent. Okay? So it's an open question whether or not this short time signature of chaos, which is this T Lyapunov, exists in these kinds of systems, and what the best observables for probing them might be. Okay, lots of questions. So.
Yeah, if I consider a relativistic theory, what is the interplay between butterfly velocity and speed of light?
So the butterfly velocity ends up becoming the speed of light. And it's so the picture here in the circuit models, you have a maximum speed, which is 1, because you're just acting with the circuit and it can't leak out of the circuit. So in the circuit models, your picture is you have a cone, which is V light cone, which is 1. VB is generically less than V light cone. And then it's kind of spreading in time. And as Q goes to infinity, this kind of goes on top of that, and the spreading goes away. So in a relativistic system, you're stuck at VLC, and then there's no spreading.
In a relativistic system, you effectively have Q equal to infinity?
No, but it's analogous to the Q equals infinity behavior in that you don't have broadening, and your speed is set by this, by C.
Yeah, just can you comment on the relation of this measure, operator spreading measure of normalization, and thinking about like density matrix and a wave function and angular moments?
Yeah, so...
Are they the same, or is it some...
No, so that was one of my questions, which is how do we precisely connect, things like this to... thermalization, right?
I'm sorry, but thermalization means that it's distribution over energy, right? That it goes to a certain distribution of energy. As for chaos in the wave function itself,
right.
It's not its wave function, right? It's not.
No, right, but here's,
so it doesn't look the same, right?
Well, no, but here's the sense. Okay, so here's what I mean, right? So when you start with an initial operator, right? And that has some initial expectation value at time t equals 0. Okay. And the process of thermalization is how is this hidden, right? So as t increases and you measure a naught of t at some late times, you know that this has to, if a is a local observable, you know that this has to agree with the thermodynamic answer, right? So thermalization is a process of hiding the information that was present in local observables at time t equals 0. And one way in which this is hidden is because this operator becomes very, very non-local. So there's this kind of decoherence in operator space because it's getting non-local and you're not probing the non-local stuff. And so, you know, so the process of thermalization you can think of, and what I'm going to turn to next really brings that out. You can think of it as operator dynamics, but the measures that you would consider are different.
But thermalization implies that it is incoherent stuff, because you say, let's say in an energy basis, you have,
right.
You know, distribution of different energies, right? And in this way, it's like about psi square rather than about wave function itself. While, you know, chaotic behavior
right.
Wave function could be at the level of wave function itself.
No, that's right. But one of the things we're trying to understand is how does this chaos emerge under unitary time dynamics,
yeah.
Where in a sense, everything is coherent, right? You have this operator
right.
That's evolving in time,
yeah.
And it is this coherent superposition of all these different Pauli strings. So you want to ask how is incoherence emerging from the coherence? And one way is that even though this operator as a whole is evolving coherently, it's evolving coherently over more and more non-local and non-observable stuff. So when you look locally at some observable, it looks incoherent. Right, and that process is driven by the spreading of this operator in time under unitary evolution. Yeah.
Is the role of the density matrix, the thermal state, you know, finite temperature, just to set up like a background density of operators so that now there's just like, instead of just like Q this way, one
right.
That way, it's like less than Q this way and more than one that way?
There's a way to think of it like that. That's, let me
so
not get...
It slows down.
Yeah.
Okay.
So there's a way to think of it like that. Let me not get into that. Okay. Yeah.
I would expect the relative age bond between VB and H. Very naively, I would think of the conjugation of the Heisenberg conjugation.
Yeah.
The VB is a bias, as you said.
Right.
That's what we
right.
Would call a driving. Whereas if you do any sort of an extra commutator on top of that, which I would count as another age bond. So.
Because I did set H bar to one everywhere, but.
When you do that
to get D, you just look at the expectation value of X squared instead of X.
Right.
And then again, you have this kind of biased problem. So you can get it exactly just from solving X squared minus X whole
yeah,
squared.
It should be consistent with your statement from before that in large N systems.
Right.
You don't see D because
right.
You're sending an effective H bar to zero by picking up the leading order sharp growth of the front.
I see. Okay, yeah. That might, yeah. I haven't thought of that, but that may well be true. Yeah. Okay. All right. Okay, so I'm going to move on now. Okay, so as I said, one of my goals was to understand how dissipative hydrodynamics emerges from reversible unitary dynamics, okay? So to model this, and again, you know, the systems that I'm talking about here are very general. Any Hamiltonian system has energy conservation, and if you're talking about just some general system away from any quasi-particle integrability and all of that, you expect the energy relaxation to be diffusive, okay? So this can be any system with some diffusive dynamics having to do with slow modes like energy or charge conservation. And again, to give myself an analytic handle on this problem, I'm going to again think about these random circuit models. But now what I'll do is within the random circuit, instead of having my gate, so suppose this was a gate that acts on 2 degrees of freedom, right? So this is a spin 1/2, spin 1/2. So this is a 4x4 matrix, and instead of it being a completely hard random 4x4 matrix, I'm going to build in a U1 conservation. Okay, so I can build in SZ total conservation by saying that the up block is just some random phase, the down block is a random phase, and then this up down block is some 2x2 random unit ray. Okay, so that's how I'm going to build in conservation. So I'm going to have SZ total, which is sum over ZI, I goes from 1 to L. That's conserved, which means that U of T SZ total is constant. Okay, and again, this is just a global conservation law built up of these local densities, and I'm working with SZ total instead of energy just to give myself okay. And what this expression, what this conservation law gives me is, you know, previously I was talking about dynamics with this sum rule on the weights of 4 to the L Pauli strings, okay? What this will give me is a sum rule on the amplitudes. So now I'm not talking about weights. I'm going to talk about the amplitudes themselves on these L local densities. Okay? So the way you get that is you know that the trace of O of T as the total is constant in time. So when I expand this operator out, SZ total is just a sum on those L local Pauli strings. And because of this orthonormality of the trace, when I take this object, I just pick out those L components which have to do with those L conserved densities. Okay. So what I'm doing here is I can separate my whole set of Pauli strings into two groups. There's these Z sub R's, which are the conserved densities. These are local. And then there's everything else. Okay? And these are mostly non-local, right? A typical Pauli string in this set is going to be very, very non-local. And because it's non-local, it's non-observable. Okay? So I can take a given local density. So let's say I start with z0 at time t, z0 at the origin, which is one of my local densities, and I see how this evolves in time. Right? So again, I can separate this into these pieces. And this is the part of z0 of t that's on local observable stuff, okay? And now, because you have diffusion, right, if you weren't thinking in this operator language, and I just said, here is a system, it is diffusive, right, what you'd say, if I asked you, what is trace of z0, v of x of t look like? Well, you'd say, well, it's a diffusive system, I'm just measuring this two-point correlator, so it's going to be right? But notice that when you are doing this, because of this operator way of thinking, you're picking out these components of this spreading operator. Okay? So what that tells you is that these guys, AZR of T, are diffusive. Okay? So I'm looking at how the portion of the operator that's on this given local conserved density, how is that going down in time? And because you have this slow diffusive mode in the problem, what you find is that's only going down as a power law in time. Okay. Generally, let's think about the completely generic case, right? So there your operator is becoming extremely non-local. Once in some time t, it has spread over a distance t, which means it has spread over roughly 4 to the t operators. So if you ask what's the portion of this operator that's living on some single one-side operator, it's going down as 1 over 4 to the t. Okay, so it's going down exponentially in time. And the presence of this one conservation law has slowed down that exponential decrease into something which is a power law. Okay, so that's the first result, that because of this slow process, you end up with a significant portion of the operator that's left behind on these local conserved quantities, right? And the portion of the operator that's on those is only going down as this power law in time. Yeah.
So is your second equation there a hypothesis, or did you?
Good. So intuitively, this is what you expect. In this random circuit model, we can solve everything exactly, and you get that. So you get.
Is there any reason to believe that this physics should be represented by that model?
Well, it's a model where you have nothing special and you have a local conservation law.
What is the time-time correlation of the each on-site operator in this model?
What is the time-time correlation? What do you mean by time-time correlation?
So you should be able to tell either the state or the Hamiltonian on each site at a given time.
Okay.
And then tell how that correlates with the later time.
Right.
That controls your diffusive cost.
Correct. So what we find for that is So if you didn't have this conservation law built in, because you're hard random, right, it's a completely Markovian process, if you will. So there is no time-time correlation. It's totally incoherent.
Yeah.
But because you have this conservation law built in here, what you find is that for these conserved amplitudes alone, which are these AZRs, it is a coherent process. Okay, and you can just derive all of that exactly. And then you find that these, you end up with something that looks like a binomial, like because you're doing this in a discrete thing, you get your binomial forms, and then those give you your diffusion upon coarse graining and taking the scaling limit. Good.
That top equation, is that an operator equation? There's an operator in front of AZR?
ZR. Because this is the operator in front of AS prime.
And these are all the other operators.
These are all the other, that's right, exactly. And these AZRs are coherent under the dynamics of the circuit, so you end up. So that's why there's always an implicit Haar average here. And in the non-conserving circuit, if you had a Haar average over just any amplitude on any string, it would be completely incoherent, and you'd get zero. That's why you need to take squared averages. But here, you get this coherence. Yeah.
The exponent for t over there in the denominator.
R squared.
Is that?
R squared over dt.
Yes, that's R squared. No,
okay.
In higher dimensions, would that change?
It's t to the d over 2.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. Good. So this was this is how the conserved amplitudes are involving. So now you can ask, what's the total weight on these conserved densities, right? These are these L local conserved densities. And that you can get by just doing sum over R AZR of t squared. And so you just take this diffusive form, square it, integrate it over space, and what you find is that the total weight, if you want dimensions, is going to go down as 1 over t to the d over 2. Okay. So I'm asking for the weight of this operator on these L conserved densities, and instead of growing down exponentially, it's only going down as a power law in time. But because my dynamics is unitary, the total weight of the operator cannot be lost. Okay. So what you get is this slow conversion of operator weight from local to non-local. Okay. So what happens is that in this operator picture, you have an emission of operator weight from these local conserved densities that are diffusing to the non-local stuff. And the non-local stuff is now just doing its Bayes diffusion process that I told you. Okay. So it's this coupled emission diffusion Bayes diffusion process, okay, and the emergence of dissipation now, right? So I was going to answer for you, how does slow dissipative hydrodynamics emerge from reversible unitary dynamics? And the emergence of dissipation is the slow conversion of operator weight from locally observable stuff to non-local, non-observable, and hence dissipative pieces.
So
I'm
confused about this. Okay. Why isn't it just one?
Because I squared it.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay.
Yeah. So you're right that integrated is one, but this is squared. Yeah, that's right. And what's really nice in this model is actually not only do you get this this picture of what your dissipative process is, we can actually derive a version of Ohm's law. Okay, so I can look at some rate at which this is non-conserved. Non-conserved stuff is generated, okay, at some given location. And this actually ends up being exactly proportional to that quantity, which is like the gradient of Az of x squared, which is j squared. Okay. So for my conserved densities, I had a usual diffusion equation. Okay. And what you can show is that the rate at which non-conserved stuff is generated is exactly proportional to the diffusion current of this conserved density. Okay, so this is really like Ohm's law. And what you can do is, you know, even though this is about, you know, the von Neumann entropy of some operator under unitary dynamics is always going to be conserved. Okay, what you find is that if you think of something like an observable entropy, okay, so this is the entropy observable from local pieces, the observable entropy, I can define this for those who are interested later. So d observable dt actually, the rate of increase of observable entropy, again, you can microscopically see, is proportional to the squared diffusion current. Okay, so this is again exactly like Ohm's law, but you can derive this from this very microscopic picture. Okay. Good. So, so that's okay. Sorry, I should sketch for you what the right weight picture looks like in this problem. Okay. So your right weight now has a piece that's coming from the local conserved densities that live in this diffusive region near the origin. It has a leading front, which is coming from the non-conserved stuff that was emitted. And then there's a power law tail, which is joining, this goes as to the three halves, okay? So what's happening is that, and then this reflected here. You have this diffusive lump at the origin, okay? And then the diffusive lump emits some non-conserved stuff. The stuff that was emitted at time t equals zero makes it all the way to the end and forms the leading front. But at all times in the future, there's some rate at which non-conserved operators are generated. And then those form lagging fronts. Those then start propagating at some speed vb. And they can't catch up with the main front. Okay, so then you get this tail of lagging fronts. And your operator spreading picture ends up picking up this power law contribution coming from your slow diffusive mode in the system. Okay, and a similar tail shows up even when you measure the out-of-time ordered commutator. Okay, good. So, do I have 5 minutes to make this point? Yeah, okay. So, just wanted to come back to this point about the existence of the Aponov regime, right? So notice that in these problems, because of what I said, C of xt has this form, right? And as a result, this does not look like a simple exponential in time, okay? Which is coming from this front broadening, okay? And in any case, you can ask when you have a quantum system, right? Not away from any of these, let's forget the limits even. If you have a quantum system that isn't classical, what do you need to define some kind of Lyapunov exponent, okay? And one of the things that you need is some small parameter, right? So you want your C to grow at early times to scale with some small scale epsilon, okay? And the reason for that is that in a classical system, you can make a small perturbation and some separation between trajectories can grow without bound forever, okay? But in a quantum system, you know that your operator norm is conserved and this commutator at late times, it cannot grow without ground. Okay, it just goes to something order one. So if you want to start with something small and you know that you're bound to get to something order one, okay, if you want to extract some exponential time scale out of something that goes from one, zero to order one, you need to get some long separation of scales over which this growth happens.
But in quantum system, you have, say, finite size, then you have a gap, right? So then your perturbation should be larger than something, because otherwise you are not reaching the next level.
Exactly. So the first point is that you cannot make an arbitrarily small perturbation.
Yeah.
And the second thing is that your perturbation, your size of the commutator cannot grow without bound, okay? So you need this small parameter to start, because then you're going to see exponential growth over time, some time scale, which scales as 1 over epsilon, or 1 over lambda log 1 over epsilon, okay? So if you make epsilon really small, you can get some long period over which to observe growth, okay? So in these SYK systems, for instance, this epsilon is given by 1 over n, for instance, or 1 over n squared, I'm not sure. Okay, but it gives you, so as you take n to infinity, you get some parametrically large separation of scales over which to see this growth. Okay, and it was believed that even in a spatially local system, because of spatial locality, you know that if you measure the commutator between two operators, they start off exponentially small, and it takes some time, which is linear in that separation, for them to grow. So maybe you could have gotten some separation of scales based from spatial locality alone. But what this analysis tells you is that even in a system with spatial locality, when you have front broadening, you cannot get the simple Lyapunov exponent, okay? But instead, what you can do is, what you can do is, instead of defining your otox at a fixed spatial location, right, so this is C of x naught t, what you can define are velocity-dependent Lyapunov exponents. Okay? So now I'm going to probe these along different rays. So you can look at C of x equals vt t and use this to define a lambda of v. Okay, so you're going to look at how this, so this is my Lieb-Robinson, v Lieb-Robinson. Okay, that's the cone. And you can look at these commutators along different rays, which are either outside the main cone or inside. Okay, and what's actually really remarkable is that if you go back to Lieb and Robinson's original paper, the Lieb-Robinson bound today is not stated in that language, but if you go back to their 1972 paper, they actually define a velocity dependent, the exponent that they define for the decay is velocity dependent. It makes use of this velocity, okay? And so then what you find is that for V greater than V Lieb-Robinson or V butterfly, okay, your lambda V is negative. Okay, so this is probing the decay of correlations while you're outside this Lieb-Robinson cone. Okay, and for lambda of v, for v less than v Lieb-Robinson, okay, lambda of v may or may not exist. Okay, so only in, so this is saying that if you're well outside the front and you're looking along these rays, just spatial locality alone. So there's nothing about chaos, right? An integrable system, free fermion system, spin chain, whatever you wish. If your system is spatially local, outside the Lieb-Robinson cone, you'll get a negative Lyapunov exponent, which is probing your which is probing the decay of correlations coming from locality alone. And then once the front gets to you, whether or not, which is V less than V Lieb-Robinson, whether or not you have a positive lambda V regime depends on whether you're on one of these large n limits or not, okay? Because you need some separation of time scale for you to grow even after the front gets to you. In a spin 1/2 system, your otog grows to order 1 in some order 1 time after the front gets to you, so then there's no, this does not exist, okay? So this is a question mark. And here, lambda v is less than 0. Okay. So some sketches for what lambda v looks like is this is in some classical, it goes to 0 at VB, classical, semi-classical, large n, etc. Whereas in some strongly quantum system, which is my spin 1/2 chain, it's negative and it kind of smoothly goes to 0 at VB. Okay. So this does beg the question of what we can, and I shouldn't, you know, so there was one, the thinking was that the OTOC may be useful as some early time signature of chaos in these many-body systems undergoing unitary time evolution, but away from these special limits, okay, the dynamics of the front really look very similar between all these different classes. Like even for an integrable system, this work that we recently did showed that you get diffusive front broadening, but now it's for very different reasons, right? So in an integrable system, you have quasi-particles, it's as far from chaotic as you can get. But even in such a system, you end up with an operator front that's actually diffusively broadening, and it saturates to something that's non-zero at late times, because it's interacting. Yeah.
But when Q is large, it was like a shock.
That's right. When Q was infinity, it was like a shock.
So when you have lots of operator internal dimensions or whatever to grow into, then it's okay. But when it's like,
That's right.
QCD won't have a Lyapunov exponent.
Right. So you need some large. That's right. You need some large. You need for there to be something that even when the operator front gets to you, you need to take a lot of time to.
The red becomes blue and green instantly, and then
that's
just
right.
Done.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. I think I can be done. Okay.
Thank you.
More questions? Any more questions?
One question. Is there a bound of how negative that lambda can be when it's outside of the Lieber-Robertson bound? Is there maybe an observation?
Not really. I mean, I don't know if you have a finite system if something, but in general, this can just go.
Okay. So you showed that the Lyapunov exponent is always well defined outside the cone, right?
But it's negative.
It's negative, yeah.
Yes.
But can we extract any information about quantum chaos from looking at that negative number?
No, so one of my points was that because it's negative, all it's encoding for you is locality, nothing to do with chaos. So you could you could do this in an integrable system and you'd get a curve that looks like this.
How can you connect the two pictures?
Connect the two pictures?
Yeah.
Okay. Good. right. Okay. So let me connect the simpler picture for you. Okay. So this is going to zero like V minus VB to the alpha. Okay. And alpha is related to this front broadening exponent. Okay. So what the first thing that happens is as so you can get something that becomes, right, so as your front broadening goes away, you can get this to become alpha equals 1, okay? And when that happens, so there's two answers. The first is if you don't have these larger n degrees of freedom, blah, 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 then this doesn't, then there is no positive regime at all, okay? Whether or not you get a simple exponential growth has to do with whether alpha is greater than 1 or less than 1, okay, or equal to 1, sorry. So when you look near VB, if it's going from positive to negative, then you can do a Taylor expansion near VB, and then you get your leading order alpha equal to 1. But you can also have cases where alpha is 1, but then it doesn't continue into a positive regime. But even in these cases, if you looked outside the front and you went up like that, you get a simple exponential curve, okay? But one way to connect these pictures is suppose you had a curve that looked like that, right? So then you see that as you take some larger n, suppose you were in some infinite n system and you look like that, and as you start building in finite n, you'll end up with something like this, which then eventually just goes to that. Right, so you have some small crossing here with some small linear piece, but then this just becomes that.
And the broadening that makes it.
Yeah, so there was a paper recently by Brian Swingle and his postdoc, Sheng Long, and what they did is this Brownian circuit model. So they had a bunch of coupled dots, and each dot was like a random circuit. And then they asked what happens for that problem. And in the infinite end limit, it's like a Fisher KPP, so again, you get this picture. But then when you add in finite end corrections, you get a front broadening that scales as 1 over log n cubed. So it's a very small broadening. But any broadening causes kind of a discontinuous change in alpha, if you will. So, yeah.
How do you get this delta x to the minus 3/2 tail?
Right. So this is, if you look at how the weight in this is going down in time, yeah. It's so this is for one dimension, right? So you know that rho conserved, like the total weight, on x and t is 1 over square root of t. So yeah. D rho c dt goes as t to the minus 3/2. So you want to see what's the rate at which you're losing weight from your conserved density. And then the stuff that you emit makes it out to some distance here and can't make it all the way. So this is just given by the rate at which non-conserved stuff is generated.
Counts with the square, right? It's an integral.
But the weight is all generated at the origin, because the diffusive stuff is hanging out near the origin, right? It's only in the square root of t thing.
I want to clarify just one thing. This function in the box is a conserved integral.
Correct, but this is not.
And its square is not conserved, so that's...
That's right, and that's the point, because this is a picture for the square, because it's this right weight. So this is the picture for, I think I erased it, so it's rho sub r of x is sum over s ending at x a sub s of...
Thank you.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you. One more time.